Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out. It's Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. So today we've got episode 126. This is a bit of a follow-on. I think the case can be made that maybe I should have done episode 125 after this one. But they go hand in hand, and you can just listen to them in whatever order you want, and it'll all work out, I'm sure. So this episode is going to be talking about varroa mites and why I have kind of labeled them as like the HIV of the bee world. And we're going to talk about why they're so destructive. And you guys are probably like, Jeff, every time I listen to you, man, every time I turn around, every time I play one of your episodes, I watch a video on YouTube, I'm always hearing you go on and on and on about varroa mites. And I have to do this, folks. This is so, so critically important. I want you to be successful. And I don't even know what to do. I have no other way that I can think of to convey to you the level of importance in treating other than to just say it over and over again. Now, before we jump in on the episode today, I do want to talk about something that came up in the Discord room within the past day that I wanted to talk about. This is sort of a self-induced problem that I created. Over the years, I started out with episode 1, 2, 3, 4, just very sequential numbering system. Over time, what was happening is people had emailed and said, hey, I really enjoy everything that you're talking about within the beekeeping space. But to be honest with you, man, like, I don't care about your RV. I don't care about your sawmill. I don't care about what you're doing at your property. I really just want to learn about beekeeping. And then simultaneous to that, I had people who were emailing and they're like, hey, man, I really enjoy these stories you're telling. Keep it up. Love hearing about it. So I was like, well, crap, how do I find a way to balance it? Like, how can I have that discussion casual, like, hey, this is what's going on with me and whatever, while still addressing the needs and educational wants of everybody who's trying to learn beekeeping and become a new beekeeper? So I came up with this naming convention kind of a while back. And what I did was I created the Bee Buzz. So the Bee Buzz was 100% dedicated to answering emails, giving my opinion on those types of things, talking about some personal updates and things like that. That seemed to be okay, right up to the point where then I added in Bees in the News. So now we were in a situation where we had like Bees in the News episode 8, Bee Buzz episode 20, regular episode 80 or whatever. So there's all these separate numbers. I think it was becoming confusing. It definitely was for me. From a management standpoint, when I was trying to migrate to a new hosting platform, it had a lot of challenges with it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to rename the whole thing. We're just going to go one through whatever, and it's going to have to figure itself out. So what you can do if you're looking for, first off, if you're in our Discord room, I've posted an entire list of what episode, 0 through 126. They're all posted within the Discord room under a channel called Podcast Episode List. So if you're thinking about a subject or a topic, you can just kind of browse through there, find the episode, go right to it. I'm also going to try and track down a legacy list, something that was a list, prior to me redoing this naming convention that I can hopefully post as well. I'm not sure. I think I have one. I've got to dig around and see if I can find it. But one thing to keep in mind is if you hear me say in an episode, oh yeah, that's going to be talked about in Bee Buzz episode 10. You can still find that within the episode list. It's going to be a little bit of work, definitely easier through the Discord room. But what you'll see is you'll go and look, for example, episode 105, and it'll say the Bee Buzz, and in parentheses, it'll have a number 10. So you'll know that that's the old Bee Buzz episode 10. Now, the other challenge with this is inside those episodes, I was saying, hey, welcome to episode 32, and you're looking at your player, and it says episode 38, something like that. So I will actually go back and manually edit every single episode. So we're, like I said, we're at 126 now. And I started doing this probably somewhere in the, you know, 118 range, something like that. I'm going to go back and I'm literally going to edit the audio on every one of them and fix this. It is not number one on the priority list right now because I've got a lot of, you know, things that I have to get knocked out. And we've got this, this Master Beekeeper program that we're working on. There's a ton of stuff going on right now. So I promise you that I will get back to it. Worst case scenario, if you're running into a roadblock and you're like, Jeff, I'm not messing with that Discord room. I don't want anything to do with that. Drop me a quick note. I will find a way to translate whatever you're looking for and get it figured out for you. I do apologize for the inconvenience. It is certainly not intended to be that way. I knew at some point I would have to go back and fix it. So hopefully that's not causing too much pain and suffering for all of you out there. Okay, so we're going to jump in with a little bit of background information on the varroa mite. So the varroa mite, it's called the varroa destructor, and it originated in Asia where it evolved alongside with the Asian honeybee. So it's Apis cerana, whereas most of us here in the Western Hemisphere, we're dealing with the European honeybees, which is Apis mellifera. So these Asian honeybees, they developed a natural defenses to managing the mite. And a lot of this is through grooming behaviors. So they've coexisted and co-evolved together, and they have the ability to mitigate a lot of the challenges that the mite presents for the honeybees. But unfortunately, our European bees, they did not have the exposure to the varroa mite, prior to the past few decades. So they have to learn these behaviors. It's going to take them time to figure that out. Now, when you heard me just mention grooming behaviors, there's a couple of different types of them. So there's auto-grooming. This would be like a self-grooming. This is something you'll see a lot if you see a bee kind of reach up and pull their antennae down, and they'll kind of, clean it up a little bit. Obviously, it's important. It's an important sensory organ to them. But there's a lot of things they can't get to. A good example, and you've seen, I'm sure, some pictures of honeybees that have mites on their back. They don't have the joints like we do as humans, where we can kind of reach behind and grab between our shoulders or reach back underneath, underneath of our arm kind of, and reach behind and sort of scratch our back. They don't have that ability. They rely on and depend on each other. Just like if you've ever seen like a primate group of chimpanzees or something where they're kind of digging in each other's hair and they're eating the bugs out of their hair. So that would be allogrooming. And that, worker to worker grooming is what the honeybees will do. And that's the behavior. That's that hygienic behavior that we're hoping for in the bees genetically so that they can remove those mites before they've had a chance to do any kind of damage to the bee. So it's a combination of this grooming behavior. It's a combination of a few different things. One of them is just, good cleanliness, right? To keep dust and pollen, debris, anything that might get on another bee. There's, of course, the pest control aspect of it, getting mites or parasites or other things that might be physically attached to the body, being able to remove those. And then there's the social, bonding component to it. So the grooming does help to strengthen, the colony's social structure and the cooperation among the workers. Now, diving a bit more in back on the history side of things, so the mites first arrived in the U.S. in 1987, so the impact since then has been incredibly devastating. The mite has wiped out, I would say, arguably, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hives in that time. I mean, it's been and continues to be a really serious health risk for honeybees. And, what's terrible is, up until 2022, Australia didn't have them. And now, in 2022, once they discovered they were there, they, launched an incredibly aggressive multi-million-dollar campaign to eradicate the country. And there were a lot of angry beekeepers. In fact, if you are an Australian beekeeper and you'd like to discuss this with us or whatever, let me know. Reach out to me. I've talked to several folks from Australia and New Zealand and folks within the region there on a few occasions. And I would be really curious to get your perspective. But it's my understanding that they were a little bit over aggressive in some of the things they did as far as how they were destroying and euthanizing a lot of colonies just to try to eliminate the mite. But unfortunately, they hit a point where they were just like, it's here, we got to deal with it. So what's the big deal, right? Why are they so destructive? Why is it a real big problem? It's not just the parasitic nature of the mite feeding on the bees, specifically feeding on their hemolymph. So on a quick little like biology sidebar, hemolymph is the fluid equivalent of blood in vertebrates, you know, like honeybees and other insects. So it's a mixture of blood and interstitial fluid. It's going to contain, you know, water, ions, nutrients, hormones, waste products, hemocytes, you know, like your immune cells and things. So unlike the blood in invertebrates, it lacks red blood cells and hemoglobin, which, you know, transports oxygen. So the mites will feed on that hemolymph, and in turn, that's going to weaken the immune system of the bees. In addition to that, the mite is a vector for viruses, and it spreads them directly into the bee's hemolymph, which, you know, again, it's the, like the circulatory fluid of the bees. That's why I often compare it, you know, to HIV. It doesn't kill the bees outright necessarily, but it leaves them vulnerable to a host of secondary infections. So I'm going to do a quick list here of some of the common viruses that are associated with high mite loads and that you'll see from varroa mites. So you have DWV, or deformed wing virus. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to do just a quick highlight of each of these, and then I'm going to explain a little more detail afterwards. But DWV is going to cause bees to emerge, you know, from their capped cells with crumpled or deformed wings. Now, next on the list is the sac brood virus. So this is going to cause larvae to fail to pupate. So you have egg, larva, pupa. They will not make it to that pupal stage, and it turns into like a fluid-filled sac. Pretty gross. Next is going to be acute bee paralysis virus. This leads to trembling and paralysis in adult bees. And then you have chronic bee paralysis virus, which causes hairless and shiny bees as well as paralysis. And then last on the list, and this is not all inclusive, but these are just the most common, but the Israeli acute paralysis virus, IAPV, this is associated with a rapid colony loss and sometimes CCD, or colony collapse disorder. So while we mention CCD, this is a relatively generic term for sort of anything that can go wrong. There are a host of things that go wrong. We're going to talk about this, I think, a little bit more, a little bit further down in our discussion. But I think it's important to separate the definition of, we think of a disease as like tuberculosis. It is a single thing. Like CCD is a single thing. It is a whole bunch of different things that could be happening with one or more of them together to then cause this. Because remember, a colony will self-collapse if it becomes sick. If a worker bee realizes that she is sick, she says, oh my God, I'm not feeling well. She'll walk out the front door of the hive, fly away, and never come back. If a lot of bees get sick, they will all leave and not come back. And that subsequently causes the colony to collapse. So it's not, I just want to make sure you understand that it's not like a single diagnosis of like a cancer or something like that. Now, I can tell you a story. There was a warm day, late winter one year, and I noticed that I think it was like 4 out of 5 hives in this group of 5 were flying, and they were really busy, and they were getting some of that early, you know, late winter, early spring kind of forage. And there was one colony that wasn't moving, and I thought, oh, they're a dead out. I guess they're not, you know, they're just not going to make it. I opened it up, and there was still some food, you know, food reserves available. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I got down to the lower part of the brood box. I was looking around, and there was a cluster of bees there. And I thought, well, they're not moving. They weren't moving at all. So I moved off to the side, you know, got them to a place where it was safe to kind of extract everything. And I just started shaking all these bees out onto the ground, you know, well away from the regular area where my regular bees are. And I saw they were moving. And I thought, oh crap, were they just really cold? This is like year two or three. I thought that they were maybe just a little cold, a little slow to get moving. No, they were paralyzed. One of these illnesses that we just referenced here, one of them was definitely infecting this colony of bees, and that's why they could barely move and they were unable to survive. And again, that was during that time where I thought, nah, I don't need to treat. Some people need to treat, but not my bees. My bees are so amazing. They won't need that kind of treatment. So I want to kind of focus in a bit on things that are easier to see. And you've heard me say this many times, and I'm going to keep repeating it because I think it's a good way to approach things. I'm certainly open to ideas and thoughts on better ways to do it. But I always tell you, learn what normal looks like. Focus a lot of attention and energy on understanding what normal is supposed to be. Because normal is kind of like one way. You know, there's really only one way for it to be normal. There's a whole lot of ways it can be abnormal. You don't need to be an expert in what's wrong. You just need to know that something is wrong. So starting out with DWV, deformed wing virus, it's really easy to see because bees that have it, they tend to be smaller, weaker. They're not able to fly. You know, the wings, again, can be malformed or crumpled, real shriveled looking, or even in really extreme cases, they can be completely absent. Now with sac brood virus, you know, that affects obviously the brood and worker larvae primarily. And that's also caused, you know, by a viral infection, and it halts the development. So the infected larvae die after their cells are capped, and then the body just transforms into the, you know, like I said before, the fluid-filled kind of sac due to that accumulation of viral particles. So the fluid-filled sac that I kind of referenced before, it's initially sort of a pearly white color when the larvae start out, but later on they take on more of like a yellowish brownish hue as the virus progresses within the cell. The dead larvae skin is going to become really tough, rubbery. It's going to create the, you know, the characteristic sac filled with fluid kind of look. And they often appear like stretched and glossy. So one of the signs in the hive is that the cappings of the affected cells are going to appear perforated or sunken in. And this is as workers are detecting and recognizing that the infection is present, and they're attempting to remove the infected brood. Another kind of telltale distinctive feature to help diagnose this is the dead larvae will often lie in sort of like a banana-like shape within the cell. So when you see that, that's really not what a developing pupae is supposed to look like, or pupa is supposed to look like. So that's another thing, that air quotes kind of banana shape is a common thing as well. While sac brood is much less devastating than, you know, some of the many other bee viruses that are out there, you know, outbreaks can indicate that a colony is stressed out, maybe has some kind of a weakened immunity, might be due to poor nutrition. It could be high, you know, high mite loads, other environmental factors. So this is why whenever something is going on within the hive, we have to do our due diligence and become detectives. You know, I don't care if you've been beekeeping for 1 year or 10 years, your investigation kind of needs to be the same. I'd make the argument that in beekeeping, it's very much like a lot of other things where people who have less experience can often do a better job of figuring out what's wrong if they take a systematic approach to diagnosis. So many of what I would call like your air quotes experienced beekeepers, they're quick to jump in for, you know, to give a diagnosis. I think it's a combination of reasons why they do that too. One of them I think is because they say, well, everybody's counting on me to have the answers. So because they want, you know, they want to know how awesome I am, I got to tell them right away, oh, I figured it out. This is the problem right here. Boom. And they also sometimes will know that proving them wrong might be really difficult because there's a lot of things that could be at play. So people are like, oh yeah, well, this guy's pretty smart. He must have the right answer. Now, the other thing, or the other part of that, or number two, is, you know, there are so many things that will present with similar symptoms that it's often really difficult to nail it down without additional testing and analysis. Now, I'm going to give you an example of why it's important to do that detective work. Years ago, I was a paramedic. I was working in an auto accident, and I don't remember it being a bad accident. I've been through so many, I don't remember all of them, but I don't remember it being a bad accident. But I remember the person being really kind of confused and disoriented. And I've, you know, you run enough alcohol, DUI type of calls, you can kind of tell when someone's drinking. I didn't smell alcohol. And I was like, what is the problem? Like, was the person disoriented and that caused the accident? Like, what is the root cause of what's going on? Like, were they actually impaired? Were they taking a medication? Because that's, if I don't smell alcohol, I'm inclined to believe, okay, well, maybe they've self-medicated with some other kind of pill or something like that. Well, the state trooper wanted to arrest the person for suspicion of DUI. And I said, hey, can you give me 5 minutes with him in the ambulance before you make any decisions? He's like, yep, do what you got to do. But, you know, let me know because we got to move. So I get him in the back of the ambulance. I do my regular vitals and all that kind of stuff. But I get the glucometer because I'm like, I want to check their blood sugar because, you know, you get around enough patients and see enough things. You know, you kind of realize there's some things happen repeatedly. You see some things that are going to happen over and over again. And I'm like, let me just take a shot in the dark here. Now, normal blood glucose for somebody should be between 80 and 120 for most people, right? Some people's normal, you know, it might be 124. Other people's normal might be 75, right? If you can focus and you can, you know, you're cognizant of things, you know where you are, you know what's going on, and your blood sugar is a little bit lower, but that's normal for you, that's fine. Anyway, if memory serves me correctly, this gentleman's glucose level was like in the 50s. Right. He wasn't under the influence of drugs and alcohol. He was having a diabetic emergency. So what would have happened if he was arrested and transported to jail? Like, how long would it have taken them to realize what was going on? It's the same kind of thing when you're doing this detective work. Don't just take one little thing that you see on the surface and run with it. You know, do a little bit of homework, do a little bit of extra effort to see if you can really figure out what's going on, and ask, you know, ask around. The tough part is, in beekeeping, there's so much information, and there are a whole lot of people that are right in the middle. They're in that like 3 to 10 year kind of range of experience. And even in that range, sometimes there's people here who really haven't been doing that much. So the 10-year person's really not any further ahead than like a 2 or 3 year person. So you have a whole lot of people who have a little bit of knowledge, and that's almost more dangerous. Anyway, so you know that there's something there. You're not sure what it is. How do you confirm, you know, what's going on? So if you suspect that your bees are dealing with a virus, but you can't tell which one, you have a couple of options. Now, you can break out the microscope and kind of study, you know, the bees for more detailed signs. Now, you aren't going to be able to see, you know, the actual virus with your home microscope. By the way, I'm actually not joking on having one at home. I think I got one on Amazon a few years ago. It was not that expensive. It works really well for what I do. And it's really just hyper zooming in on things so that I can just see some things just to play around with. It's not anything designed to be used for scientific, you know, scientific research for anything serious. But it really comes in handy when you want to just, you know, check some things out and get some really good zoom for it. The other option, though, is in the U.S., you can send samples to the Beltsville Bee Lab for professional diagnosis. So if you want to do that, what you need to do, collect a specimen of about 100 to 200 symptomatic bees, freeze them immediately, pack them in a leak-proof container or bag, and ship them to USDA-ARS, that's Alfa Romeo Sierra, Bee Research Laboratory, 10300 Baltimore Avenue, Building 306, Beltsville, Maryland, 20705. Include your contact information and a brief description of the symptoms, and they should get back with you and let you know what they were able to determine. As far as I'm aware, like, I don't know what their limits are about how often you can send things. I've never sent anything to them myself, but definitely use that resource. But also, it's important to, I mean, you know, leveraging resources within your state apiarist and your state ag department, they can provide some resources as well. If you are outside the U.S., you do have some options here. Now, I didn't obviously research every country, but I'm just hitting the next three kind of where I know that people are listening to the podcast. In Canada, there is the National Bee Diagnostic Center. It's located in Beaver Lodge, Alberta. It's the NBDC. The Honeybee Research Center, HBRC, it's part of the University of Guelph in Ontario. So that's where Paul Kelly and his crew are. Lots of good content on YouTube, so definitely check them out. But that's another option for you. If you're in the UK, you have the NBU, which is the same thing as the Special Victims Unit. It's just for the National Bee Unit. But you can send, you can do the same process with them. Reach out to them, find out the contact information and what they would need for you. You can also use the Oxford Bee Lab, which is at the University of Oxford. My daughter actually had the opportunity to go there for a summer learning thing at school, and she had a great time. And if you are in Australia, this is kind of a cool acronym here. It's the BEE. It's the Behavior, Ecology, and Evolution Lab, located at the University of Sydney. So there's a couple options for you depending on where you are. Now, inside of your hive, what do you need to watch for? When you're inspecting your hives, you want to keep an eye out for kind of the common indicators. We talked about the deformed wings being an obvious one for deformed wing virus syndrome. But looking for hairless, shiny bees, they might be trembling, kind of like a little bit of some spastic kind of behavior and activity. Spotty brood patterns, this can be an indicator, because if you see spotty brood, the workers, the nurse bees who are overseeing that, if they find something they don't like, they're going to pull it out and they're going to discard it. If you see a lot of that, that might be a pretty good indicator that there's something going on, you know, at the larval development level, larval slash pupae developing level, that needs to be investigated. So that would be another good thing to look for. Sudden population decline, right? So if you see a lot of adult bees dying outside the hive, or all of a sudden, you know, you had this massive spring buildup, now you're going to see a big spring buildup and a summer decline where I am. Some places you have the big spring ramp up, nice maintenance all the way through summer, and then a drop off going into the fall. Every kind of race of bees and location of bees, lots of different variables involved in this. But if it's the regular peak of your season and things are going well, and all of a sudden there's a big drop off, You want to do some investigation on that one. Now, one of the more obvious ones here is high varroa mite counts, right? And of course, you can do an alcohol wash, your dish soap wash, the sugar shake. The sugar shake is the one that I call the shake and bee syndrome inducer. But, you know, whatever one you want to use, I think that the alcohol and dish soap ones are the most accurate, but it doesn't matter. Okay, if you're doing a sugar shake and you find four, and if you did an alcohol wash and you found five, okay, does that change your whole strategy? If the sugar shake, as an example, was less accurate and it was reporting two and the alcohol wash was reporting 20, well, that's something you want to reevaluate. But I think it's going to get you close enough, right? I mean, it's going to be fine. So this comes back to why I kind of beat this into everybody's brain like repeatedly over and over again. Please let my early failures guide you. There's still so many people who invest dozens of hours of time, you know, pretty much every week, the time, the energy trying to become beekeepers who suffer needlessly because they don't have a varroa plan. I mean, I would seriously recommend scoping out your varroa approach and figuring out what your plan of attack is going to be before you even purchase bees. Treatment methods, approaches, different ways of doing things, they can all get very pricey. And you need to kind of mentally and financially prepare yourself for this expense. You know, everybody's getting excited and pumped up about splitting in the spring. And what are they asking about, right? What kind of hardware? How many frames? How much this? How much that? Please make sure in the process you're saying, how much more varroa treatment am I going to need? How much more expensive is that going to be? And that can really drive things. Now, maybe you have four colonies and you're going to take them, make one nuke that you sell to finance all of your varroa products for the other three, something like that. So just, again, just be mindful of that. So the key takeaway here, varroa mites, they're not just parasites. They are enablers of some of the most destructive diseases that honeybees will face. So managing your mite levels is absolutely critical to keeping your colonies healthy. So that's going to pretty much wrap things up for today. So I've got an episode coming up after this one talking about choosing the race of your bees based on where you are. There's a few things I think are important with that. I shifted that in place because somebody else had brought a question up about, in fact, it was Jose who had asked the other day, yesterday, he said, hey, should I order the same bees from the same place that I bought last year? And that's a really great question. So we're going to go ahead and put an episode in talking about that and some other things to help you better decide, you know, which bees are going to be right for you. The short answer to that question is it depends, but we're going to really dive into it on that one. And the other episode that I've got right after that one is talking about why some people's queens tend to seem like they're dying or being killed or disappearing every year around the same time. Simple solution for this for the most part, but there are a few other things that could be going on as well that we want to be mindful of. So folks, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you being here. Please check out the YouTube channel. It's just at Beekeeping for Newbies. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S. And you know, check us out online, beekeepingfornewbies.com. Please sign up for the wait list for the Master Beekeeper program. That way we get you in there first. People on the wait list are going to be eligible for the earliest discounts. We're still on target. Everything is moving as planned to have the apprentice course released on 1 April. So that is all going great. Join us in the Discord room if you have questions. You just want to reach out and chat. There are some really goofy people in there, but I love them to death, and we have a lot of fun together. So outside of that, take care, be kind to one another, and remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.